The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
So Francis McCamey was one of the earliest mainstream Presbyterians who did get persecuted over here. He had to fight for the right to preach as a nonconformist in New York and gained some of those rights and so forth. And the mainstream Presbyterians had actually formed a presbytery in the early 1700s. I think I've mentioned before, we don't know the precise date because the first page of the minutes book is missing. So we don't know when the first meeting was held, but around 1705, 1706, and then they formed a synod as more presbyteries developed, and in 1729 actually adopted the Westminster Confession and Catechisms as their standards here in America, with allowance for certain differences, people scrupling over the role of the civil magistrate. And eventually that gets revised or amended in the American form. The Covenanters, thus, were distinct from the mainstream ones, just as they were in Scotland when they came over here to America. They maintained their separate identity. The only minister at this time, 1743, when the first such church was formed, was Alexander Craighead. Craighead had been mainstream Presbyterian. And when the Great Awakening occurred, the revivalist movement in which George Whitefield played a major part, and in New England, Jonathan Edwards and others, the Presbyterians split, you know, in 1741 over the revival into Old Light and New Light, or Old Side and New Side. And the New Side, as you would expect, favored the revival. The old side were very much for upholding the doctrinal standards and also Presbyterian government, and were dismayed that some of the revivalist preachers were invading the parish of other ministers, sometimes even preaching so enthusiastically that the implication, if not the explicit charge, was that you people, your pastor's an unconverted man. And Gilbert Tennant preached that way, and even George Whitefield preached that way until rebuked by Jonathan Edwards, and then he changed his ways, and Gilbert Tennant eventually repented of his having preached in that fashion judgmentally. So, but the church split over those issues from 1741 to 1758. Now, Craighead, it's interesting, in terms of that split, he favored revivalism. So he was like the New Side in that respect, but he also was very much a strict subscriptionist to the Westminster Standards. So he'd be more like the Old Side in that respect. And he eventually left and moved into the Covenanters. So he led in renewing of the covenants by what he termed descending obligation. So the idea was that each new generation of the Covenanters should renew the covenants and carry it on that tradition. Now, unfortunately, Craighead had another problem, which was drink. By the 18th century, this was a problem in a number of the churches, and I guess particularly on the frontier, I'm not sure. But it was one reason he got pushed out of the mainstream. It's ironic that he would be involved with the Covenanters because they are very strict total abstainers, teetotalers. Today, and a lot of their people have played a major role in the WCTU in America in the 19th century and on, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. But at any rate, that was part of his problem. But the there was no American Covenant or Presbytery formed until 1774, and that was at Paxtang near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That's now actually a suburb pretty much absorbed by Harrisburg. When three ministers had arrived, John Cuthbertson from Scotland had come to America in 1751, and Matthew Lind and Alexander Dobbin arrived from Ireland in 1773. So once you had three ministers and more than that number of churches, you had the basis for an actual functioning presbytery. This is why in the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod, we celebrated, excuse me, the 200th anniversary of the RP, the Reformed Presbyterian Church, in the synod that was held at Elizabethtown out here in Lancaster County in 1974. Which year was that? Yeah, 74. I had been moderator of the synod in 73, and so was retiring moderator in 74 and was able to work with the committee to have this big celebration of the bicentennial. And we did kind of a renewing of the covenant at that time. And Jack White, my friend from the RPNA, represented them and came and joined with us and so on. It was so foreign to our tradition, as I'll explain in a minute, that when we did this, I asked Jack White, after we had renewed the covenant, what he thought of that. And he said, well, when we do it in our circles, it would be a lot more serious than this. We were doing it in a mode of celebration. And while the words were great, I don't think our people were ready really to, in effect, sign the dotted line and say we're really renewing our commitment to the Lord. It was a joyful time. But I realized this was something much more serious that the covenanters did with regularity, at least from generation to generation. Then if you look at the chart, you can see that a merger took place with the Associate Presbytery. This is up in the very top right-hand part of the timeline. The Reformed Presbytery, having been formed in 1774, merged with the Associate Presbytery in 1782 to form the Associate Reformed Church. And as so often happens, when you get a merger, you also get a split. You'll usually have part of the group that will go in, and there's always, almost always, a remnant that stays out. And so you can see there's a dotted line there from 1782 of Reformed Presbyterians who did not go into that merger. But they didn't have any ministers. And so they eventually had some ministers and formed the Reformed Presbytery again in 1798. And then you can see it carrying on down to 1833, where there's a division. The background of that division is that the Covenanters never did like the U.S. Constitution for a couple of reasons. One was its failure to recognize Christ as king, but the other was its recognition of slavery. And that shows up in the way in which votes were allocated to states and so forth. And you remember that it referred to so many people and their chattel. And that referred, unfortunately, to slaves. And they would get three representatives according to each one of the chattel, counting as three-fifths of a person. And the Covenanters, to give them credit, from a very early time were opposed to this type of practice of slavery in America. So they never did favor the U.S. Constitution, and hence they did not participate as citizens, would not vote or hold office. And that's continued to be true of the RPNA down to very recent times. They've just in the last decade or so, I think, decided to participate in American society. By 1808, the slave trade was abolished in the British Empire, and hence there were not new shiploads of slaves being brought from Africa to this country. And the Covenanters decided they could support the government in the War of 1812. But division came in 1833 over the issue of the civil government, the so-called new lights, the ones that lead into the church I was involved with, the RPCES, gradually dropping such distinctives as exclusive psalmody and worship without musical instruments, and also the practice of close communion. The proper word is close communion, not closed communion, but it means the same thing, and that is that the covenanters, and this is traced back to the field meetings of the times of persecution, would admit to the Lord's table only members of their own denomination. And so they didn't have the communion open to other believers, but it was very strict, and you often had to have a token showing that you had gone to a preparatory service prior to the communion service in order to be admitted to communion. Now, this group then, the New Light group, eventually merged in 1965 with what was at that time called the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. And that's the group I was born into. Well, no, I wasn't, actually. My parents were still in the PCUSA when I was born. But before I was old enough to know what was going on, they joined the Bible Presbyterian Church. And Dr. Carl McIntyre, who's still going, last I heard, he's got to be almost 90 years old now, pastor of the Collingswood Presbyterian, the Bible Presbyterian Church of Collingswood, New Jersey, and head of Faith Seminary in Elkins Park, and still on the radio, blasting the communists and the Catholics and so on. He was in my childhood home on several occasions and formed the Bible Presbyterian Church in St. Louis, of which Francis Schaeffer came to be the pastor eventually. So that group, you notice I have here in 1956, most charts of Presbyterian history do not get this point right. But I was there, so I know what really happened. 1956, Dr. McIntyre was in the minority at the synod meeting. The Young Turks of that day, let's see if you would know any of those people now. Jerry McFarland, sitting in the back row, would probably know some of these people. Thomas Cross, who just died in this last year, Bob Rayburn. Francis Schaeffer was in Europe, but he was part of this group. Donald McNair, who's still going fairly strong with his parachurch organization called Churches Vitalized. They took a stand against some of the ethical practices of Dr. McIntyre, who had done some things like during World War II, what's now the National Council of Churches, it was then called the Federal Council of Churches, which would be the conglomeration of the mainline denominations, had tried to convince the government that they represented Protestantism in terms of getting chaplains in the military and so on. And it's ironic because now most of those denominations would be anti-military and almost pacifistic. And we have a lot of good people serving rather high up in the military chaplaincy right now. David Peterson, one of my former students, was head of all chaplains in the Gulf War under General Schwarzkopf, and we really had an amazing influence. I don't know if any of you came to seminary after being in the military. That's not so likely now as it was some years ago, but many, many people were much affected by some of our chaplains in the military and felt the Lord's call to ministry and would come to seminary. But at any rate, at that time, back in the 1940s, the issue was, what about these other separate denominations that weren't in the Federal Council of Churches? So Dr. McIntyre had petitions that were circulated, and my uncle and his brokerage firm circulated petitions like this as a matter of civil rights, and his Jewish partners signed this thing and so on. Well, then McIntyre took these petitions and said, this is our constituency. This is what we represent, you see, and there were thousands of names. And my uncle knew these were not Christian people, many of them. So it was that sort of false communication. Another famous one I recall, as a young person was the Christian Beacon, which our library still gets occasionally. He doesn't publish it weekly anymore, but we used to get it in our home. Would have a big appeal to send Bibles across the Iron Curtain into communist Europe. And it turned out that what these were just little portions of Scripture that were being attached to balloons and being sent by the prevailing wind across the Iron Curtain into the East. But a lot of money was collected on what seemed like false pretenses. So my uncle was one, as an elder at that synod, who got up to oppose this sort of thing. And Bob Rayburn, Tom Cross, Don McNair, people like that also opposed it. And I was there as a college student sitting in the balcony of the church when Dr. McIntyre stood up and said, "All who are with me, come meet out under the trees." And that's where the Bible Presbyterian Church Collingswood Synod was formed. It was about a fourth to a third, so it was clearly a minority. And so that was 1955. By 1956, it had become a distinct synod. And our group met in Columbus, Ohio the next year, so we used to get called the Bible Presbyterian Church Columbus Synod. And by 1961, we didn't want to be identified with Dr. McIntyre's group anymore, so we changed our name, even though we were the majority group. That's why I have a straight line going from Bible Presbyterian to Evangelical Presbyterian. And then in 1965, we merged with the Reformed Presbyterian General Synod, or New Light people, who were really down to about, at that time, they had maybe two or three or four sizable churches, one of which was the Willow Grove Church out here, Calvary Church Willow Grove. Another one was in Pittsburgh and a few in Illinois, but they were very small and merged with us, and we took their name, essentially, and their numbering of synods to give us a little more historical heritage. But we were then the RPCES, and you can see then in 1982, that group joined the PCA. To back up a little bit, you can see that the Orthodox Presbyterian Church formed in 1936 when Dr. Machen was put out of the Northern Presbyterian Church as a result of his stand for orthodoxy. He had formed Westminster Seminary in 1929, and then had written his great book, Christianity and Liberalism, in 1923. So the issues were very clear that early. He had urged Dr. Warfield of Princeton before his death in 1920 that perhaps it was time for a real separation, a division to come, and that those who really stood for the truth of God's Word should take their stand, and maybe the whole church would divide, and you'd have a large contingency holding out for the truth. And Dr. Warfield sort of sadly shook his head and commented, "You can't split dead wood." So already by 1920, Warfield perceived that the church, the Northern Presbyterian Church, is so departed from the truth that you wouldn't be able to get a clean-cut split. And indeed, that's what happened when Machen was finally put out, in effect for insubordination, for forming the Independent Board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions in 1934. And those people were all forced to get off or be disciplined by their presbyteries or sessions. Some of them were lay people. And that led to Machen's trial. It's interesting now that some of the people up at Princeton Seminary and some of the people in the Northern Presbyterian Church are reviewing the whole Machen trial. And they're beginning to see, now a younger generation coming along, that that was really an unfair trial. And it's very interesting to see how Machen's name is beginning, thanks partly to Daryl Hart's book, is becoming known once again. The most remarkable thing, Dr. Logan and I were at the ATS, the Association of Theological Schools, biennial meeting in June of 94, held in Atlanta. And I was in, the thing was over several days. At one point I was in a small group as they broke us up to discuss different issues, their accreditation standards and so on. And there was somebody I'd never met before, but he turned out to be the dean of Bangor Seminary in Maine. which is reputation as a very liberal Baptist school. And he started talking about J. Gresham Machen in this small group discussion. I could hardly believe my ears. And didn't get a chance to talk to him before we went on to the next plenary session. And some controversial issue arose at that session. Here are all the representatives of all the seminaries across the USA and Canada. And I think the thing had to do with how the funds of ATS would be invested. You know, there was a typically politically correct, non-discriminatory clause. And some of people of our type were rising to the microphones and saying, you need to remove this one about gender things, because surely we don't mean to support the gay movement by this. And of course, the Catholics tended to agree with the evangelicals. ATS is very interesting now because it was originally a mainline liberal type thing, ecumenical. But then when they started including the Catholic institutions, that proved to be a great help to the evangelical schools like Westminster, like women's ordination. You see, the ecumenical people don't want to force that on the Catholics. All of which could change any time, but right now it seems to work. But anyway, this same dean from Bangor Seminary went to the mic and said, what this organization needs, and this is now in the plenary session, we need to get back to the sound theology of people like Thomas Aquinas, Jonathan Edwards, and J. Gresham Machen. And Dr. Logan and I felt like standing up and cheering. But it's really quite amazing. And one of our former students here who had left Westminster, he was a Baptist and came from Maine. Turned out he had enrolled for some courses at Bangor Seminary. He called me shortly after that in the summer to get me to write a reference for him. And I asked him about this man. He says, oh, I think I know the explanation for that. He said, one of my, this man apparently teaches American religious history, one of my fellow evangelicals here took a course with him and did his paper on Machen. And this Professor Sonzo had never heard of Machen before, but he was so impressed by what he found out that he's become quite a champion of Machen now. So I don't know. It's another indication of how we might need to pray in these days. You know, Thomas Oden, who's at Drew Seminary, has been a remarkable convert to evangelicalism out of almost a postmodern framework. And he's become anathema to most of his liberal friends now. But he's still there, a tenured faculty member at Drew, and quite well-known as a scholar. He's published a lot of works in systematic theology. He's a Methodist, and part of what got him back into biblical material, orthodoxy, is that he really studied John Wesley carefully and then saw how Wesley was making use of the patristic material. And that all brought him back to orthodoxy. And not that any of us here would necessarily agree with everything Thomas Oden might say, but he's sure on the side of the angels now. And I think that's something we need to remember. Sometimes the odds seem so overwhelming that we fail to realize what God can do. And we ought to be praying. That I've been praying for some years since I got personally acquainted with some evangelicals still in the pastorate of the PCUSA, for real revival in the PCUSA. That's what would bring the right kind of split, because I think too often the most hardened liberals often hold on to the endowments, the key positions, and so forth. So we may not get all that in the properties, but the mass movement, which means the people with the children and the grandchildren, the generations yet to come, might still see the light and sacrificially make a big move. I think we need to remember that in the Reformation, the revival, which was the Reformation, did not come through the Waldensians, who were the Bible people that were sort of on the sidelines. But it came in a monastery right in the heart of Roman Catholicism, where God moved to save Martin Luther. So it may happen that way again in our day. And we may be right now more in the position of the Waldensians, but our job is simply to be faithful, keep preaching the word, keep living out the Christian life with full fidelity, and call on God to glorify his name in the timing and the placing that he sees fit. Anyway, that all came by my talking about Machen. You see where the OPC was formed in 1936. The tragedy at that time is that Machen died within a year after the new denomination was formed in January 1st of 1937. That was a huge blow to this seminary, as you can imagine, as he was out in North Dakota preaching and trying to carry the cause to churches out there in the middle of the winter, not the place to be. He caught a chill and rode in an open car back some miles, a couple hours from the little church he'd been preaching back to Bismarck, and was put in the hospital with pleurisy and died in a few days. Having sent a telegram back to John Murray here, I thank the Lord for the active obedience of Christ, no hope without it. And those were his last known words, other than what he said to the pastor out there, that how did it go? Anyway, glorying in the Reformed faith. But after that, what you had basically, as Machen had been clearly the leader of that movement, which was very small. It did produce only a very small following. Then you had the kind of people who would take a stand, mostly younger people. Dr. McIntyre was among them. He would have been about 30 at that time. J. Oliver Buswell, who was president of Wheaton College, was another one who would have been in his early 40s. Dr. Van Til would have been the same age, in his early 40s. It was people of that generation that now had to take the lead. And I think what often happens when you separate to form a church that's going to be a true church at last, as Machen said, each one of us probably has in our own mind the perfect church, you know, the church that we really always wanted to have. And then you tend to magnify secondary issues. So the group that I got identified with by birth, the Bible Presbyterian Church, emphasized in eschatology, they were premillennial. The Christian life, they were total abstainers, very much fundamentalistic in many ways, against all those things, smoking, drinking, movies, card playing, dancing, so forth, famous five. I grew up with all that. And the other thing was more a willingness to work with independent agencies. The ones that became the Orthodox Presbyterian Church tended to be amillennial in eschatology. They tended to stress Christian liberty and lifestyle. They really were trying to be true to the Scriptures and say, if Christ did not prohibit the use of wine, for example, then we dare not go farther than he did. And then in the matter of church government, preferring to work through the courts of the church as true Presbyterians. And that's what they split over, those issues, within a year or a year and a half after Machen's death. And so the Bible Presbyterian Church was the minority group that came out of that. Ever since then, there have been many, many efforts to get the two groups back together. In 1975, we came awfully close. Both groups were meeting out at Geneva College, and the OPC voted. We needed 2/3 vote in each group, and they got 67.1% in favor. This was all timed, you know, that both groups were meeting in separate buildings on the campus, and we were both going to come to the vote at the same time, and then the two clerks would go and tell each other what the results were. So they made it, 67.1. My group, the RPCES, as a total vacuum of leadership for a variety of reasons, personal reasons. Bob Rayburn, who was one of the leaders of our Interchurch Relations Committee, or whatever we called it that time, had his son graduating from the Air Force Academy at Colorado, so he had to leave before we got to the vote. The vice chairman of the committee, everybody knew, was opposed, and he was the one to present the recommendation. So there was no strong speech in favor and so forth. In fact, the first man who got up to speak was the man under whom I had my internship in Gainesville, Texas. He was a man who had come out of the Marines in World War II with a natural gift to preach. And he was a great evangelist and started preaching. And people said, well, he needs to get seminary training. And people kind of took him under their wing and trained him in that fashion. He never got a degree. So he was always conscious. When I was there, I already had an MA, and he was very conscious about the difference in education between me as a young intern and himself. Gave me all kinds of opportunity to preach and so on. It was too bad because the man was a very gifted man. But he got up to speak and said, you know, brethren, I love these OP brethren, but when I go over there, I just feel out of place. George Cottenden was the moderator of the OP Synod that year and pastor at Trinity Church Hatboro, who's on our board. And you know, George is a fine man. He's very precise. And it was hard for a lot of people to imagine Brother Kyle Thurman being in the assembly moderated by George Cottenden. And so for a variety of reasons, Francis Schaeffer has sometimes been credited with influencing the vote. He had given a message, a stirring address a few nights before to not only the OPC and the RPCS, but the RPNA group that was meeting at the same time. So three groups were meeting on Geneva's campus. And he talked about putting the chasm at the right place, a typical Schaeferian language, and the unity we ought to have. But then he got up in the General Synod meeting and spoke against joining with the OPC, saying that if we join with them, we'll simply spend the next 10 years bickering. And I thought, 1985, hey, the 10 years has passed. We could have had all the bickering done by now and be united. It's sad that it didn't come off. We got 57% in favor, but we needed 66.7, so we didn't make it. So that's why the RPCS continued then without uniting with the OPC in 1975. But then in 1982 did join the PCA. I don't want to use up all the time describing these things that may not be meaningful to many of you, but there was effort to have a three-way union. And it's a courtship that's continued to go, and courtship's the right word because it's often when one is wooing the other isn't interested, and then vice versa. And it's never quite come off with the OPC and the PCA to this point. Well, enough said about all that. Let me send around one other handout, which gives you a little bit on the Huguenots and the French church. And just a little chronological listing of major events there that I won't try to say more about that. Okay, let's open it up for any questions that can pertain to this material, the Cromwell film, the larger catechism, Pelican, any of this material. We've got 1 hour tomorrow to talk about the reading for this week. And there is some very interesting reading in Bainton and McNeil, on which will give us a chance to kind of summarize the results of the Reformation by the end of the 17th century and how it affects religious liberty, the political scene, the economic life, and so forth. But I'll open the floor at this point for any questions or comments. What was the number, Tehu?
109.
Okay. Yes, what's the question? Yeah, let's read it so we all have it in mind. What are the sins forbidden in the Second Commandment? And this is really, as Pelican brings out, it's one of the distinctives of the Westminster Standards. Well, the Lutherans would have some things in this same area, but that the Protestants generally continued to avoid the images that the Catholic Church had used. The sins forbidden in the Second Commandment are all devising, counseling, commanding, using, and anywise approving any religious worship not instituted by God Himself, tolerating a false religion, the making any representation of God, of all or of any of the three persons, either inwardly in our mind or outwardly in any kind of image or likeness of any creature whatsoever, all worshiping of it, or God in it or by it, the making of any representation of feigned deities, and all worship of them, or service belonging to them, all superstitious devices corrupting the worship of God, adding to it or taking from it, whether invented and taken up of ourselves, or received by tradition from others, though under the title of antiquity, custom, devotion, good intent, or any other pretense whatsoever, simony, sacrilege, all neglect, contempt, hindering, and opposing the worship and ordinances which God hath appointed. Aren't you glad it's the shorter catechism we usually memorize rather than the larger? You can see how this is about five times as long, and each phrase with a scripture proof as well. What's your question, Tehu?
Well,
what does it really mean in application?
This pictures
of Jesus, probably next to what the larger catechism, the confession, and the shorter catechism, for that matter, say about the Sabbath, are probably the main areas where people tend to take exceptions to the standards as they become candidates for the ministry in the PCA, and I assume in the OPC as well. This part of this phraseology is one of the three places where I've taken an exception with my presbytery, namely where it says of any of the three persons, either inwardly in our mind or outwardly in any kind of image or likeness of any creature whatsoever. I feel this is an overreaction to the Roman Catholic abuses of the time. And I don't think it's possible to avoid mental images as I read the Gospels of the Christ incarnate. And so I've taken exception to that part. Now, the RPCES, just before it joined the PCA, had for about 2 years, a rather large committee, I think chaired by Stephen Smallman, who's pastor in McLean, Virginia, on this matter of pictures of Jesus. And we never finally voted on it. I think we got right up to the point. We had given responses to the committee's first report, and then they would report again the very year we merged with the PCA. So that was never completed in terms of vote, but it was a very helpful study, and it's still to be found in the minutes, which are in the library. And the basic thing I remember from that study is that certain types of pictures are not necessarily a contradiction, certainly not of Scripture, and certain other kinds of depictions are, and they tried to make that sort of distinction. It's a difficult area. You remember how, if you took ancient church, John of Damascus justified it in terms of the Seventh Ecumenical Council, that pictures of Jesus as God incarnate were possible and not contrary to Scripture. And I happen to agree with that reasoning. A man named Willett actually did the stained glass windows in the chapel at Covenant College, and they were meant to portray the covenants in various ways. Some of them are biblical material from Adam and Eve and on through Abraham and so on. Some of them are church historical. But there's one picture of Jesus, and the artist who did it, and this was after I had left there, I would have tried to correct this. The way he would portray Jesus was everybody else had a face with eyes and nose and mouth and so forth. This Jesus just has a blank face. Well, you see, I think that theologically is more of a problem, and this really tends to be a denial of the humanity of Christ. So I never did favor that. But the idea of picturing Jesus at all, I think, can be done. Now, I think we have to grant what a difficult thing this is. Like I don't think I've seen the Jesus movie, but can you imagine the challenge for the actor to portray Jesus? I mean, that's just too much to expect. And I think any portrayal, the impression made on our children One of the controversial things in recent years has been ethnic portrayals of Jesus. Well, I think most of us who are Anglo have to admit, you know, we grew up usually with something like Salmon's Head of Christ, where Jesus looks very much like somebody of English descent, a blonde, blue-eyed type person. And I don't think it's necessarily improper for African-Americans to have an African-American portrayal or Koreans of a Korean portrayal. But better, and I've seen, I had a whole book of 20th century art one time of the Gospels. It was very interesting to see how Jewish some of these artists made Jesus look. And I think that would be appropriate, most appropriate. The problem is we don't know what Jews looked like back then. They may not look the way they tend to look now. Of course, Jews vary quite a bit today. But that's, I think, what we need to see involved here. First of all, it's the regulative principle expressed very clearly that we're not to invent ways to worship God. The second commandment's really the basis of the regulative principle, that God himself is the only one who can determine how he is to be worshiped. But then I think you can see the tendency here of Protestant scholasticism maybe to push it to the nth degree, and particularly this not forming any image inwardly in our mind. And I've had to take exception to that. But I think I've had some of my PCA brethren have objected when they've come into a church building for a presbytery meeting when Sunday school room has had a picture of Jesus or something, even objected to having a cross, which to them smacks of Roman Catholicism. Well, it's a symbol that is not given in the scriptures as a symbol to be used in worship. So you can understand, I think that's going farther than we need to go by the regulative principle myself, but I wouldn't have objection to an empty cross. But you have people's consciences sensitive at different points, and you have to be careful to work it through, talk it through. Well, that's several things illustrated there, the regulative principle and the larger catechism is a much larger entity. The bell's about to ring. I did want to point out to you, well, we can do it tomorrow, but let me call it to your attention now, since Tehu's brought us to the exposition of the Ten Commandments. There's the question 99 is a very important one in the larger catechism, which gives eight rules for interpreting the commandments. What rules are to be observed for the right understanding of the Ten Commandments? There's some great hermeneutical principles right out of the Westminster Assembly given to us at that point. So you might want to look at that, and we can talk about it more tomorrow. Any other final question? Yes, Jim. In the larger catechism's exposition of the Lord's Prayer, this is really a rather minor thing. By the way, on the Sabbath, my exception there is that mainly in the area that those recreations legitimate on the other days are not to be employed. I've probably said that earlier. But in the exposition of Thy Kingdom Come in the Lord's Prayer, it refers to the civil, we're praying that the civil magistrate may countenance the true religion, the true faith. And countenance in 17th century language meant to favor. And here it is. Countenance and maintained by the civil magistrate. So it's both of those ideas. I think it's a place where the American Presbyterians simply missed it when they were amending the other parts having to do with the civil magistrate. But I affirm all the rest. Don't magnify my exceptions.